Welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast, episode 110. I'm Mo, and I'm joined here today by reviews editor Jonathan Seltzer. How are you doing, sir?
I'm still alive. I'm good.
That is a fantastic start. I'm also delighted to say that I think for the first time on the Metal Hammer Podcast, certainly in its current run, we're joined by former Metal Hammer chief editor-in-chief, I should say, and current head of Twin V, Mr. Alexander Milas. How are you doing, Alex?
I couldn't be more delighted to be here, Merlin. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We continue to roll on in this strange old world, but it's a pleasure to be able to connect with you both in this magic new way.
Indeed. It's a strange time, but in the meantime, you just have to keep on living. And certainly metal has been an incredible solace, I think, for many people. Definitely a rabbit hole to go down to. And I guess the fact that we're sitting around here means that we're actually incredibly privileged to be able to connect as a community, despite, all these strange and sorrowful happenings.
Yeah, absolutely. We got a lot of great stuff to talk about today as well. We're going to have a lot of fun. Big Iron Maiden debate happening later on, a band that we all have a vested interest in, and I'm fascinated to see how that one goes. Before all that, though, don't forget the latest issue of Metal Hammer is out right now. It's a world-exclusive interview with the one and only Dave Mustaine, and it's a wonderfully emotional and candid and ultimately very uplifting piece. Obviously, I'm not going to implore people to just kind of go out and buy it willy-nilly, but if you do happen to be doing a shop for essentials and you go past the magazine section and you see a copy of Metal Hammer in there, we appreciate your support. If you fancy picking that up, we promise you won't regret it. There's also a bonus edition of this very podcast. In fact, a video version of the podcast featuring myself talking to Trivium main man Matt Heafy about their new album, What the Dead Men Say. And we also talk about some of the strange influences that you might not have expected that went towards their classic breakthrough album, Ascendancy. And we also talk about Tiger King as well, because fuck it, isn't everybody? So you can head over to the Metal Hammer YouTube to watch that now. But yeah, as Alex kind of alluded to there, I think one of the real silver linings about this whole situation is all the great shit that's happening around the metal scene at the moment. In this week alone, we've seen that Amon Amarth's Johan Hegg is running online yoga classes with his wife. I mean, that's a sentence I never thought I'd say in a million years.
I think another great thing as well is that all the support that people have been giving to bands at the moment, especially like the bands that were supposed to be touring over the last month. So, you know, like most bands, I've been looking at the merch sites trying to help out. Everything's selling out really quickly. So there's been a lot of support on the metal scene for that. And
yeah, definitely.
We are one of those scenes. It does kind of bring out the best of us, I think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, when you look at the live stuff that bands are doing, there's almost too many to keep up with now, which is a good thing. But for instance, Cavell Attack doing that live stream show on April 10th, which I think is Friday. Yeah, Friday. So tomorrow when this podcast comes out, Cavell Attack will be doing a live stream show, which is great. It starts 8 p.m. UK time. They've actually done, like kind of Seltzer was talking about, these exclusive merch bundles that you can pick up just for the show, which is great. So there's still a real opportunity to go and support bands at the moment. So please go and do that.
I was lucky enough to see Cavell Attack live on this tour just before it all got cancelled. It was one of their last shows in Berlin.
I was going to say, where did you see them? Because, I saw them in Norway.
I saw them in Berlin, and it was like, they were amazing live. So, I know they kind of feed off an audience, but they got so much energy of their own. And new singer's great. He's got this kind of like a total crust punk feel, you know, style to him. Just leans out of the crowd. He's got this kind of very sort of lean Iggy Pop kind of look. Like Iggy Pop meets crust punk, and they were great live, and I'm sure the even without an audience, it's all going to come across.
Yeah, absolutely. And the new album's just so good as well. If you we've talked about it a lot on the podcast, but if you haven't heard Split yet, please go get it. It's the best thing they've done in a decade, and I don't say that lightly. It's a fantastic
album. It's the best album they've done since the debut.
100% agree with that. Nuclear Blast have been doing loads. The excellent Nuclear Blast records have been streaming loads of great stuff with their artists on Twitch. They've done stuff with Sepultura, As I Lay Dying, Cellar Darling, loads of Q&As and fun stuff going on there. So go check out the Nuclear Blast profile on Twitch. There's just loads of great stuff going on in the metal scene at the moment, which kind of brings us really to our first big talking point, which is the album of the week this week. We're going to do Nightwish, unquestionably the biggest thing happening in metal this week, maybe maybe even the biggest thing happening in metal this month. There's a few big albums on the way, but this is about as big as it gets right now for sure. What do you guys both think of Nightwish? I mean, Alex, you were the first editor of Metal Hammer to put them on the cover, which was a huge deal.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting for you to mention that it was a different time. I mean, it was 2008. You know, I had only recently started as the editor of Metal Hammer. And at the time, I think the publication had kind of reached a low ebb, you know, perhaps because it had exhausted many opportunities, you know, elsewhere and so on. And so I think that the resolve on my part, the resolve of, I think, everyone who was there was, let's just make a heavy metal magazine. And of course, in order to do that, you kind of have to make a conscious decision to detach yourself from any other form of music journalism or punditry out there and just completely absorb yourself in the world of what metalheads want, which sounds revolutionary to no one except someone who was in the media sphere at the time, because it was actually an obvious decision to put Nightwish on the cover at that point. Of course, Annette Olsen had only just joined, but you could see the band doing this stratospheric ascent, and it was just having the confidence in the readership and the confidence in the community to meet us halfway, and they more than did that. And I guess it was an exciting time because it felt like, from my perspective, I think from many people's perspective, it felt like the magazine began to reconnect with the community out there that wanted a magazine that didn't compromise and spoke to the kind of values and the kind of tastes that they actually had. And it was the kind of thing that you just couldn't get anywhere else. And that's not to say there wasn't a sweaty panic the night before the issue came out, but it was
know that feeling very well.
I think anyone who's ever edited a magazine does, and I guess, you know, we're in a uniquely privileged position because all three of us have done that. And the truth is, you just never know until you start seeing those sales come back. And it was heartening, it was encouraging, and I think it really set the stage for much that would come later on.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really interesting is that when you were still at Metal Hammer as editor a few years later, and we did the first cover with Fleur Jansson, I remember the same kind of conversations were happening again. It's like, oh, are they still, you know, are they really big enough at this point? Does it really work? Are we sure that this is going to be something that connects with the readership? And now we've done two more Fleur covers since then, and it just seems like the most natural thing in the world. Why wouldn't they be on the cover of Metal Hammer? Because I mean, what they've done since she's joined the band is quite phenomenal. It's one thing to have two singers in your career as a band and still do great things, but to have three and only get bigger and bigger with each change is quite an achievement.
Yeah, I mean, in my previous incarnation, I was editor of a magazine, and I think we were the first to put Nightwish on the cover in the UK.
Really? A Terrorizer?
Yeah, a Terrorizer, yeah. So this was still back in the Terrier days. And and we could sense that they were getting, at the time, we could sense they were getting huge in Germany and across Europe. And I was dubious, to be fair. And I went to see them play at the Astoria, Rest Its Soul. And I thought it was going to be full of...
I was at that gig. I remember that show.
Yeah, and I thought it was going to be full of goths, but it wasn't. It was genuinely full of metalheads. And obviously my tastes didn't quite extend to that side of metal, but I knew it was part of the whole metal sphere because, you know, we covered a lot of power metal, a lot of music with bombast, and yeah, I realised that there was a metal band, and I was really curious, like, why is it that, like, there's a whole load of metalheads singing along to Walking in the Air?
Yeah, the Snowman. Yeah.
So I knew that they were going to be huge. So I put them on the cover, and I wanted to ask that question: how the fuck does a band playing "Walking in the Air" get huge amongst metal fans? And that was a question I wanted to cover feature to answer.
Yeah, I think the history has shown that it was a very relevant question. What's interesting about this album is that amazingly, it's only the second record, kind of studio album, that Fleur's been on. She's been a part of the band for 8 years now, so it kind of shows you how the Nightwish machine has rolled back into this kind of this huge franchise that kind of isn't putting albums out every other year like most metal bands do. They've turned into a real event band now. It's an event when Nightwish put a new record out. The album's called Human Nature. It's a double album. The first half is kind of more traditional album. The second half is pretty much predominantly instrumental. Themes of kind of humanity and our relationship with the earth are all here. Stuff that I talked about with Fleur on a bonus podcast a couple of weeks back. What do we think of this record? What are we saying?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you you know, kind of think about when you consider what Nightwish's career has been, right? And it's interesting, given, you know, who else we're also speaking about in this podcast, why they have that longevity, why they could survive the lineup changes, why the singer changes have not signified a fundamental change in who they are as a band. And it's because there has been a vision there, right? There has been a consistent view of where they're going, I think, for a very long time. And in that, Thomas Holopainen is that person, you know, who's kind of ensured that sort of genetic material of the band, you know, has always, I think, remained, you know, fairly consistent, you know, through a lot of tumult. And I really see this record as just, you know, an extension of the bravado, the pomposity, and the sheer ambition and refusal to really accede to any external commercial pressure. I mean, Nightwish, they have become, like you say, a machine, a law unto themselves. And, you know, just, I mean, and this just seems to continue, just that complete exuberant, you know, denial of any rule set that any other band seems to live by, you know? I mean, the record is huge. If you love Nightwish, I think this is going to be a masterpiece to you. If you know nothing about Nightwish, I'm not sure it's the greatest entry point, because it's a lot. It's Andrew Lloyd Webber big.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the Lloyd Webber thing's such a spot on comparison, because, you know, it sounds, what Nightwish do sounds like it's something that should be soundtracking a musical, or it should be soundtracking an epic movie. You know, our reviewer Ali Cooper gave this album a resounding 9 out of 10. In the latest issue of Metal Hammer, and this absolutely feels like an amalgamation of everything Nightwish have been building towards for the last couple of albums. I mean, there's a lot to get stuck into here, but generally speaking, it's all kind of big, epic, operatic, waves and waves of kind of synth and all these different instruments turning up that we're not really used to hearing on metal albums. I mean, even just from the very first track, the first track's called Music and opens with this big kind of tribalistic rolling drum beat, war horns that sound something like off an Uruk-hai march on Lord of the Rings or something like that. And then it gives way to all these shimmering operatic tones, big orchestral vibes. I mean, it's just off to the races straight away. It's just, they're such a huge sounding band. And the single they released, Noise, I actually thought that was one of the more catchier to the point songs they'd released over the last few years. So I was quite interested in that, because I was like, oh, okay, this feels like the kind of Nightwish that, you know, Nemo came from, for instance, that kind of more catchy, straight ahead single thing. And not that anything they do is exactly straight to the point, but you know what I mean? But that's really the only song on here that's like that. There's so much other stuff going on. There's a track called Shoemaker, which is like super, super orchestral, big, big warbly vocals from Fleur, because she kind of, like, the closest she's ever sounded to the Tarja Turunen era, I think, is on this track. First three tracks is kind of Nightwish as you would expect them. And then Harvest kicks in, track four, a kind of Hey Nonny Nonny folk song, where they literally sing lyrics about grain. And it's just like, they're just this kind of, I was listening to it and I was like, you know what? It's so easy to rip the piss out of bands like this, because who the fuck writes a song about grain? Do you know what I mean? Like, who does that? And Nightwish do it, and they do it in such an earnest, heartfelt way that you can't help but be carried away by it. It's just, no one else is doing this kind of stuff. And it's easy to be snidey about bands that do things like this, but I just think, this is a band that are headlining Wembley Arena for a laugh these days. They do it every time they come over now, and they're writing songs about fucking grain. And in this track, there's instruments I've literally never heard of before. And they've got like tin whistles, pan pipes. They've got something called a bouzouki, which is apparently a Greek stringed instrument. I didn't even know what that was. I don't know where the hell that's come from. So yeah, it's just, there's just so much going on this track that makes me think there is no other major metal band in 2020 that can get away with doing something like this. No, what did you think about that particular song?
I mean, I'll be honest. In the past, I've been asked to try and define what heavy metal is, and the best one I think I ever came up with was An Absence of Irony, because it's just completely literal in every sense. And when everything is telling you that things have to be dumbed down and overproduced and all that, Nightwish kind of represent the sort of band that, yeah, they can do all of it with a straight face. And I think the word that you used is absolutely correct. An earnestness that I think people connect with. You know, I mean, we swim in cynicism these days. The media tells you that people have no attention span, and they're releasing, is it an 80-minute double album? I mean, it's kind of astonishing.
It is. It's just crazy. And in terms of the, you know, I was going into specifics for a minute there, but in terms of the broader strokes of the album, what I find really interesting about it is obviously it's about human nature. It's about our relationship to nature and the planet around us. And I feel a really like kind of warm and quite earthy vibe around this album, which isn't something you'd normally think of for a band like Nightwish necessarily. But there's quite a lot of kind of shimmering synthy stuff going on through the record, which I really like. There's a track called Procession, which if you actually pick apart the kind of the synth stuff that's going on underneath that track, it almost sounds like that kind of 80s synth wave thing that a lot of bands are doing at the moment, which sounds like a really odd fit for what Nightwish are trying to do with this album. But it's just, I thought it was a really interesting thing that they put in there. In terms of like heavier tracks, there's only a couple of tracks that I thought stood out. Pan and Tribal, they both are much more riffy, more like old school Nightwish, which was all about big riffs and those kind of hee-hee-haw kind of like operatic bits thrown in.
Can you do that again?
No. and then, yeah, the last track, Endlessness, very imperious, marching, emotional kind of number. But yeah, in broader strokes, I think, like Alex said at the top, really, if you already know that you love Nightwish, you're going to love this album. If you're not into Nightwish, this probably isn't the album that's going to sway you. But weirdly, it's actually the second disc that I find most interesting, because as someone who likes a lot of Nightwish, I love some of the albums they've done. I'm a big, big fan of Dark Passion Play, for instance, and I love a few of the tracks they've done with Floor. I didn't think I'd be sitting here saying that I really dig the kind of whatever it is, 40 odd minute instrumental bonus. No, it's not bonus disc, but second half of a Nightwish record. That's not something I ever thought I'd be into, but I really like what they do with it, because it just sounds like a movie soundtrack. I can't think of any other way to say it. It sounds like it could soundtrack a Lord of the Rings film. And I listen to those soundtracks. I've got those vinyl sets behind me right now. Like, I really, really enjoy the journey that this album takes you through. There's kind of moments that are really high tempo and dramatic, moments that are more kind of slow and lush. There's a track called The Green, which again, I've written words like warm, emotional, somber, kind of, you know, real heart, heartstring tugging stuff. I find it really, really interesting that Tuomas has decided to do this. And I think he completely pulled it off in a way that I find absolutely fascinating. What did you guys think of the instrumental side of the album?
Well, I think my experience with the album is probably very different from yours.
Interviewer, go on.
Well, I was listening to it, and compared to what I was expecting, my first thought was this is actually remarkably restrained as an album. It's really well crafted.
The last one had like a 28-minute song on it or something. So from that point,
it's really well crafted. But the lack of popping and pomp and bombast is kind of in its favour, really. So it doesn't for all the stuff that's going on, it doesn't go overboard too often. Apart from maybe, you know, maybe just because I'm not really into like kind of jigging kind of stuff like in Harvest. I thought there's some twee Disney bits in Pan, but the bits I like about Nightwish, see, I'm actually more pro the Yennette era. I think she's the most interesting. She's my favourite singer out of the three.
And that was the sound of the vinyl needle scratching off of the plate.
Great. Yeah, I'm not saying like she's technically the most gifted singer, because obviously, you know, Taria is like untouchable as far as operatic singer. It's just it's really Marmite, and I can't listen. I can't really do her vocals. Floor is an incredible singer, but it doesn't. But I just thought I loved the pop tone of Annette's voice.
And, it was basically a kind of pop, kind of commercial rock and roll. So, I mean, she felt like a strange fit for that band. And I say that Dark Passion Play is my favorite Nightwish record, but she always felt a little bit out of step with what that band was, I thought.
Yeah, but the songs I found myself like guiltily liking are the really poppy ones.
You don't have guilty pleasures here.
Yeah. But I really like the first track Music, because there's bits that remind me of ABBA in it.
Okay. And, wow.
And that's the kind of the element of the really catchy stuff is the stuff that I like more Irish, rather than just them for being epic, because they're epic in a way that doesn't really mean anything much to me personally. I don't like, I think, you know, Floor's got an incredible voice, he's incredible narrator, but I don't feel any kind of personal sort of twinge listening to it. It's just it's smooth, it's gracious, it's graceful, it has incredible range, but it doesn't have like an emotional I don't get an emotional reaction. I think this is impressive.
What did you think of the kind of instrumental half of the album? It's not totally instrumental. There's some narrated passages on there. Vocals are used as a kind of almost like a sound effect, fairly fleetingly.
Again, a lot more strained than I thought a 30-minute instrumental would be.
I agree.
I think you know, Thomas, he holds it all in. He keeps it all in rein, and so. Again, it's impressive. It's not like, oh my god, not, you know, another bunch of popping nonsense. It's not none of that at all. It flows really nicely.
I think it's
impressive, but I don't feel like one. It's not one of the kind of records that make me feel one of nature. Mm. I do like the last track on the first album, Endless, because it starts off with. Quite doomy, and reminds me of how all the other Finnish bands did really took on the kind of the northern doom of Amorphis, and
it's got a very kind of imperious marching kind of
The beginning is quite doom laden, and in a very Finnish translating sort of like Paradise Lost kind of way.
I think what you're saying about a lot of it not going over the top is what I mean when I say that the second half of the album could be, I mean, it sounds weird to compare something to Lord of the Rings and say it's not over the top. But what I mean by that is, if you said to me that Tuomas had written an instrumental side of an Irish album, I'd have assumed it was going to be ridiculously over the top, so pompous and all the rest of it. But listening to it, it's really not that different from a lot of the movie soundtracks I listen to. So it still conjures it still conjures very vivid imagery and does conjure quite an emotional reaction for me in some of the songs on there. But it never feels too self-indulgent, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely cinematic, without question. But I think, as Jonathan says, yeah, I mean, I think by Nightwish standards, restrained. By other band standards, completely, you know, off the deep end. But I believe we've all watched Battlestar Galactica, and if not, something to be rectified. Then you will know, you know, this saying so well, all this has happened before and it will happen again. Mm-hmm. And if you track the career of Nightwish, it's not entirely dissimilar from some of the biggest prog bands of the 1970s, you know, where it just sort of lived in that border territory with symphonic music, and it kind of had that sort of feel to it all. You know, I mean, Nightwish have more in common with Yes than either band is probably willing to admit, but I think their trajectory creatively is actually very similar.
Absolutely, and I'm sure Tuomas wouldn't be afraid to acknowledge that, and well, maybe he would, I don't know. I never quite know what that guy's thinking.
let's make him fight.
Exactly.
Money's on Wakeman, but let's see. Okay.
That wouldn't surprise me. It's a fucking great Nightwish album. I find myself more likely to indulge in this one than I have the past couple. I really like the instrumental side of it. I think it was a bold decision that's paid off and doesn't feel too wanky or pompous. And again, I think, you know, as a lead single, Noise, even though that's by far the kind of most straight ahead catchy song on there, I can see that being a massive, massive song for them moving forward, maybe more than anything off the last record, although I know Atlanta was pretty big. Nightwish, Human Nature is out on Friday, this very Friday, via Nuclear Blast Records. And there's some other stuff out this week as well, of course. New albums by Revulsion, Benighted and Calligram, if you want stuff a bit heavier and more extreme. There's a new Dual album, so if you like your kind of shimmering, stonery kind of stuff, I would definitely get on that Dual record. Jim Davis, who used to play guitar in The Prodigy and Pitch Shifter, has an album out now as well, and it is very much in the vein of those artists. So if that sounds up your street, go check that out. And yeah, if you want to read Ali Cooper's big old 9 out of 10 review, that's in the new issue of Metal Hammer that's out right now as well. Right. Gloves off, innit, boys?
Yeah, I've had butterflies. I've had butterflies for like the last 40 minutes. Oh, gosh. You know, I feel like I'm going to go run around the house for a second.
The good thing is that I think I know, knowing you both, I think I know what your thoughts are going to be. But I'm wondering if I might, I don't know. I'm just fascinated to see where this goes. So we're going to do the second incarnation of the Metal Hammer Podcast Hall of Fame. For those that didn't catch the last one, we did a Marilyn Manson one at the end of last year because of a few different things. Most recently, coronavirus fucking everything for everyone. We were going to do this a few weeks back, but we're going to do this right now. So the way this works is if you go to the Metal Hammer Facebook readers group, which is facebook.com/Metal Hammer Readers, every so often we'll throw a band out there. We'll make all our lovely readers and followers vote on their whole discography. And the two most most popular albums, as voted for by you guys, we will then go on to debate. And the album that we all here on the podcast vote through will be entered into the entirely fictional, but I promise you, completely prestigious Metal Hammer Podcast Hall of Fame. Last time out, we put... we didn't put Hollywood. I wanted to put Hollywood in. We put Antichrist Superstar by Marilyn Manson in. And today, an Iron Maiden album is going to join that. The two albums that you guys voted for, I've got to say, actually, I'm just going to get this off my chest. For a while there, it looked like Brave New World was going to make it in, and I was really, really stoked about it. And then it fell off a cliff.
It's a hell of a record. Can I stop this? Can I stop this before we begin?
Yes.
It's like making somebody choose a child, you know? It's just like literally, which leg would you, you know, lop off? I mean, which eyeball do you not use as much kind of thing?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
This is cruel. This is sadistic. The reader group, you know, I hope they know what they've done to us by forcing us to make this decision.
Honestly.
I'm not sure I can do this.
It feels like you're like a Trump type. It feels like you're Donald Trump type father, just making your kids fight amongst each other.
I wondered when the first Donald Trump comparison would get made, and I wasn't calling it for a Maiden poll. So
God, oh man, you know what? This is just going to be like a running thing now, because now it's all I can think about. You know, Metal Hammer, we have the best words.
Oh yes. Where's that gone? Come back. I just got the poll up so we could have a look at it. But yes, so we polled every single Iron Maiden album in existence to the Metal Hammer Reader group for this. Most albums got a vote in, which I think goes to show you how popular Maiden's discography has been across their whole career, and just how much different albums mean different things to different people. Just looking through the results now. Interestingly, the only albums that didn't get a vote were the last two. So I don't know what's going on there, because those albums fucking rule. I was wearing my Final Frontier t-shirt literally yesterday. The Blaze album's got some votes. The Paul Di'Anno album's got some votes. A Matter of Life and Death polled quite highly. As I said, Brave New World looked like it might be in the conversation, which I would have loved, because that was the first Maiden album I got into. But there can only be two for this. And the two that you guys decided we'd have to debate, A Power Slave and Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. Maybe not that surprising, as the two albums to make it through that, you know, Power Slave. Well, let's just go into it full heartedly. Let's start with Power Slave. Maiden's fifth album, third with Bruce Dickinson, of course, at the helm. Interestingly, this was the first Maiden album ever at the time to feature the same lineup as the one before it. So Bruce, Steve, Adrian, Dave, Nico were all on Peace of Mind. They all came back for Power Slave. So what I guess we were seeing at this point was the Maiden machine really clicking into gear, having some stability in the ranks for the first time, and really powering forward and making a record that, I mean, you know, this is all about personal preference, but in terms of their kind of legacy, Power Slave has got to be a shout for the definitive Iron Maiden record, hasn't it?
You know, it's difficult to, you know, choose Maiden records, one over the other, simply because the longevity of their career and how so many different albums represent completely different creative tentpoles for where the band was. And so you find that they kind of compete with their own legacy, you know? And so, you know, the thing that makes it so glorious to be an Iron Maiden fan is that you can totally connect with younger generations of Iron Maiden fans for whom something like A Matter of Life and Death is their first Iron Maiden record, which completely trips me out because it feels like it came out yesterday, but that's because I am literally as old as time. But, you know, but yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if we're saying this is our desert island disc, you can only choose one Iron Maiden record, that's one question. However, were you to say what is the definitive record, that could be seen as another, you know. And I'm just going to sort of like string this suspense out just a little bit longer here.
No, oh, we will. We're gonna milk this for all it's worth.
Yes. Okay, so how what is the rationale for choosing when you say best? Is it the definitive? Is it your personal favorite? Is it the one that you argue? I mean, you know, give me some rules here.
Well, I'm going to say, not to leave it, not to kind of shirk my responsibilities, but I kind of think we can take best as however we like. I mean, to draw the comparison, when we did Marilyn Manson, Elle was very pro Mechanical Animals purely because she felt that song for song, it was the best collection of songs Marilyn Manson had ever put together, which I think is probably true. Steve, on the other hand, felt that Antichrist Superstar is the Manson album. It was the album that defined him. It was the album that introduced him to the world at large. And it's probably the album that the benchmark for him will always be put against.
Hollywood was the masterpiece myself.
Well, I agree. That, I mean, again, you know, my first choice didn't make it into that one either, so whatever.
Okay, so it sounds to me like maybe what you're saying is, you know, so there's an academic response that we can give, and there's also maybe like, so or we could imagine a completely hypothetical situation where you're forced to self-isolate. You can only go out for essential activities, and you're only allowed one Iron Maiden record to choose from. So maybe that's the one we're going with.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I know what my choice is going to be for this, and I don't think I can answer your point without giving it away, but let's just say if you have to choose one that you want to listen to for the rest of your life, this is the Podcast Hall of Fame. This is not necessarily the definitive, you know, this ain't the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This isn't like the Grammys. This is our list. We can do what we want with it.
Oh man, let's do this, okay?
I'm really shirking my responsibilities here. I'm not committed to it at all.
No, we're aboard the little Cessna. The door has opened. The parachute instructor is pointing at us, and he is saying, "You got to jump now."
Yep, we're going in. Well, let's do it. Let's just take both albums separately, talk them through, and then we'll do something of a vote at the end, shall we? As I said, Power Slave, released in 1984. Third album with Bruce really feels like a record where the band hit their stride. The kind of more, I guess, you know, we'd already seen them more from this kind of punkier, more urgent young metal band into this more kind of epic and gung-ho kind of outfit. And I feel like Power Slave was the album where that kind of more gung-ho, fun, epic, almost fantastical, you could almost say, aspect of the band really started to come into play. I mean, if we kind of take it from top to bottom, surely Aces High and 2 Minutes to Midnight is the greatest 1-2 of any Maiden album in history.
I was just about to say that. But also, you can hear on Aces High, them kind of like, they've still got that kind of, those riffs, it's still got that kind of punk element. So you can see them kind of slamming those riffs off and almost like evolving in real time. So it's still got that element of early Maiden in it, like in the kind of the sort of the bite of the riffs, especially at the beginning of Aces High.
Yeah, and I mean, to go from that, Aces High is seen as probably the greatest Maiden set opener. It's just such a vital track of theirs. Like, it's got so much love in the Maiden community, and rightly so. And then to go from that into 2 minutes to Midnight is, I would argue, my first, I don't want to say negative, but my first kind of potentially contentious point is that I think that sets the bar so high for this record that following it up with that instrumental, Lost for Words, is in hindsight, is an interesting choice, I think. Thoughts, gentlemen?
I guess it has to coast a little bit after that. But I think, you know, there's elements, but I think, I think Lost for Words and Flash of the Blade, they do something different from the intensity. Like, the way they use the twin leads, especially Flash of the Blade, it's, and the Duelist actually as well too, it's this very similar thing that, you know, to what Thin Lizzy do. There's a kind of ease with which the twin leads kind of ring out. But I actually, especially on Flash of the Blade and the Duelists, I prefer the way that Thin Lizzy do it.
Yeah, and you know, I think that, you know, we have to obviously, you know, consider the time that this was released in and how most people were actually consuming their music. I mean, it was vinyl, you know, or it was cassette. And so, you know, the way that people listened to an Iron Maiden record, you know, would have been incredibly linear, you know. And I will confess, I listen to most Maiden tracks these days out of sequence because you're usually kind of going for those ones. But, you know, there is a logic to the sequencing here. I think you're absolutely right, Jonathan. But I guess that's the thing. It's like, I think this is the record where Iron Maiden go from being a band set amongst the new wave of British heavy metal, and they go into the phase where they simply become something that Jonathan, I think, brilliantly described years and years ago and still stays with me, the creation of, you know, what he called Maiden World. You know, suddenly Maiden became their own planetary system, you know, with you know, their own creative orbits, and it just didn't matter what anyone else was doing. And I think this is really where that sense becomes very, very apparent to me.
Yeah, it's interesting that you both made very important points about how music was being consumed then, because I actually made a point to listen to both these records on vinyl before we started this podcast, because you just get a much better feel of how the album was structured, how it would have been consumed at the time. And that will actually bring me to a point with Seven Sun a bit later on. But it's just interesting because Aces High and 2 Minutes to Midnight are just so the two tracks that everyone talks about from this record. I think people forget about that really interesting portion afterwards where, you know, like you said, Jonathan, you got Lost for Words, you got Flash of the Bay, you got the Duelist, you got those fun kind of twin leads playing off each other. It feels a bit more gung-ho and pacey and not knockabout, but kind of like just fun, kind of like off the cuff Maiden dueling, which is really good fun.
Yeah.
And you go on to side two, and you touch down with Back in the Village and then Power Slave into Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Really kind of like, you can almost see the kind of film they've crafted, like reaching its climax with those two tracks at the end.
And especially I think Rime of the Ancient Mariner also sound, because, you know, the core riff of Rime and Power Slave, they're quite similar. So Ancient Mariner at the beginning, it really does sound like an extension of the title track, Power Slave.
That's an interesting I just
think though, like with Flash of the Blades, I think, and the Duelist, like the reason why I think like Thin Lizzy did those twin leads better at the time is, well, there's something about Thin Lizzy that they do something for me that no other band does. And the minute I hear Thin Lizzy, everything feels all right with the world. That everything feels connected together. There's that kind of ease with which Phil Lynott sings. And it's got its earthiness, but it's got its total ease. But I think on like the Duelists, because there's a lot, so much pace going on, and especially, I want to talk about this later on, about Steve Harris's bass on this album. I think that kind of ease of the twin leads and the busyness of what else is going on in the song, they don't quite conjoin together, they don't quite play off each other. And so it doesn't put you in the center in quite, doesn't center you in quite the same way that Thin Lizzy do when they use twin leads.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Alex?
Yeah, I certainly don't disagree, but I think, you know, at the time, I mean, the first time I heard the Power Slave record, and, you know, funnily enough, it was not the first Iron Maiden record I heard. I would have been 8 years old at the time. You know, I kind of went back, and I wasn't really kind of intellectualizing it, you know, to that extent. It just all sounded, you know, just unlike anything else I had really heard, you know, because when I was beginning to listen to things was in the late 80s, and it just felt absolutely unique. And of course, you know, being that age, the first thing that would have been apparent to me wouldn't have been the twin leads. It probably would have been like, is this the same, is this about the Ridley Scott film, about all the fencing and all that kind of stuff? And I suppose, you know, just there is a young boyhood or girlhood imagination that just sort of gets piqued by all of these things. And so there's still an incredible sense of fun, you know, that's kind of happening here, because, you know, I mean, throughout all of, you know, Maiden's career, you get the distinct sense that, you know, it reflects, you know, one or two band members' VHS collection, you know, and that's what makes it all kind of brilliant. But, you know, I mean, we've already talked about, you know, you've invoked the name of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. I mean, literally, as far as I'm concerned, it could be just the sound of broken glass for 45 minutes, and then they do Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and it would probably still exist in the same kind of lofty mental bracket, you know, as it would otherwise, simply because, I mean, you're talking about a 13, nearly 14 minute, I mean, just what do you even call it? I mean, it's just so out there and brilliant. I'm sorry to skip ahead, but
I know it's all good. I mean, it's just unignorable, isn't it?
It's big. It's big.
Yeah, I mean, literally the longest song they've written to that point by some distance, I think.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I came into Maiden through Brave New World in the early 2000s, like I think many of a certain ilk did, because it was when Bruce came back and there was so much fanfare about it. And so by the time they actually got around to playing some of these tracks live for the first time, it was seen as a massive, massive deal. And my favorite gig I have ever been to was Maiden at Twickenham in 2008 when they did the Somewhere Back in Time tour. And the thing everybody was talking about at the time before they started the actual tour itself was they're bringing back Rime of the Ancient Mariner. They're doing Rime of the Ancient Mariner again. And even now, you know, they've beaten that record for longest song, I think twice over since then. But it's still just such a towering achievement for what they did. And just the kind of the scope of doing a near 14 minute song about a poem from the 1800s by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, quoting passages from it and everything else. It's just so ambitious and so epic. And in the hands of a lesser band, it could have ended up turning into a bloated farce, but instead it turned into one of the single greatest achievements that metal produced in the 80s, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you're completely right. I mean, so much of what I think Iron Maiden were doing in the 80s was very reflective of the musical vocabulary they were acquiring as music fans in the 1970s, right? You know, and of course, a lot of that, it wasn't rock music. It wasn't just metal music. It was obviously a lot of, you know, what we call prog music as well, you know? And so to see them kind of like, you know, invoke something of that scale is pretty, pretty impressive, but it also bespeaks a band who knew who their fans were, because, you know, like you say, a lesser band could have done it really badly and really alienated people, like, what are you doing? But no, instead, you know, it was just the creation of legend, you know, and it was just so, so important for them as a turning point.
Absolutely. And I think we should also mention the real kind of imagery around Power Slave as well. I think that, you know, the Pharaoh Eddie still remains, arguably by some distance, the most iconic Eddie they ever produced, certainly amongst Maiden fans at least. You know, their show was getting bigger and bigger by that point, but I think it's probably fair to say that the Power Slave era was the first time where it felt like they were bringing a show. It was an unmissable, huge kind of like stage set and all various fucking shit going on all over the place. Like, they took things to a level to which not just they, but in many ways, a lot of metal hadn't done to that point.
I think it's also the cover as well. I mean, not just the Eddie, but the whole cover itself. Like, you know, those kind of Egyptian colors are really strong. That kind of that geometry, it really pulls you into the, you know, it's got such a like a central sort of, point of origin. So it really pulls you into the sleeve. Also, something about Ancient Mariner as well is that it's also like in a weird kind of way a microcosm of the whole pace of the album. The way it sort of starts off really strong, you know, gets a bit more, you know, gets a bit more chilled out. Then the way it kind of all pulls it all back together again. It's what Maiden always really good at, is just when the whole band kind of follow each other and you feel the whole thing sort of, and you feel the whole machine kind of click into gear again. And, you know, I love those metronomic riffs when Power Slave kind of, when Ancient Mariner kind of really sort of kicks in again.
Yes, absolutely. What do you think of the kind of, you know, where their show kind of went to at that point as well? Because it feels like that kind of set the standard for what everyone expected of a Maiden show from then on.
Yeah, I mean, Maiden don't do bad shows, do they? So
No, but I'm talking about in terms of the stage set and the kind of, you know, the ancient Egyptian theme. Like, it felt after that point that the theme of Eddie and the theme of the stage show and the theme of the album was a massive part of their identity in a way. Maybe it hadn't been quite up to that point.
Well, the first time I saw Maiden live was up in Newcastle, and Bruce Dickinson was in jeans. There wasn't really much of a stage set, and they just brought a big Eddie on at the end. So that was kind of a, by Maiden standards, that was a fairly low bar. So I'm always like, but every Maiden show I've seen, I love the, I love the Final Frontier set. You don't want them to be doing the same thing every time, but yeah, of course, it is spectacular. And it is, as far as imagery goes, it's very definitive.
Thoughts, Alex?
Well, I'm sorry to pull us out of just, you know, the album talk, but into, you know, kind of like the history of Maiden. But, you know, it's what's so cool to note about this record is that, this is obviously part of like a much bigger plan. Because they were about to embark on, you know, just like, you know, in the annals of rock and metal history, there are a few tours that, you know, invoke the same kind of sense of scale and ambition that the World Slavery Tour, you know, invokes, you know, nearly 200 shows, 28 countries. I mean, it's just an unbelievable feat. You know, I mean, just like Maiden went from being a successful band to a, I guess they were just world dominating by that point. And, it's just so interesting to think, you know, that this is something that happened just in a few short years. I mean, this is a band on a stratospheric consent. A stratospheric ascent, I should say. And, things like Rime of the Ancient Mariner, a lesser band wouldn't be able to pull off. A lesser band would not do that at that point in their career. They'd be doing what they can to get as big as possible, but instead they were doing the thing that they always did so well, which was sort of like defy commercial expectation and just get bigger and bigger in the process somehow. And I think that created a bond between them and their fans that I think exists to this day. It's just a feeling of trust that if Maiden are doing it, then it feels like the right thing somehow.
Absolutely. And it's something that they just carried with them. Till right now, as a matter of fact, they've just never stopped with that kind of ambition and vision. Let's move on to Seven Sun then. And I think before we do, it's crucial.
Can I just say one caveat about,
okay.
About Power Slave, and everyone's going to want to kill me.
Please.
But I have one issue. I have one major issue with Power Slave.
Oh.
And it's Steve Harris's bass on this album.
Oh.
What?
Okay.
Let me go with this. It's so, like, his bass on this album is, it's so overbusy. He just wants, again, every nook and cranny. And he just plays too many notes that seem to be not always going where the song needs to go. On this album, you can hear it in there's a drop off in Power Slave where it sounds like he's playing a different song because he's just getting it. The bass sounds really taut and tight. That's a kind of essential. It sounds quite preapic, and it's just busy bouncing around everywhere. And I think the bass on some of the tracks here, they're a bit overplayed. And once I hear it, I can't get it out of my head. It just rattles around a little bit too much.
Good grief. That's amazing.
I know this is an outlier position, but and I don't really feel it the same way on other albums, but I do on Power Slave. And just once you start focusing on his bass, it just kind of takes your attention off from other aspects of the album. It's not always going with the groove. So sometimes it's just fitting in too much for the groove.
Wow.
I'm going to have
to talk about Power Slave.
I am going to have to listen to Power Slave again over a beer and consider Steve Harris's bass playing.
I am. I'm going to have to do the same and consider Jonathan an ex-friend. No, of course not. So yeah, we will move on to Seven Sun now.
Okay,
we could do a whole podcast on one of these albums, really, couldn't we? Each. I think it's really important to acknowledge the album that came between Power Slave and Seven Sun, which was Somewhere in Time, because that was the album that really saw them start to like ramp up the synth and the keyboards, guitar synthesizers, and all that kind of business. And you know, it was a controversial move. It might seem strange now, but it was a controversial move for a lot of their fan base. That they did that. You know, Somewhere in Time has aged very well. It's a very beloved album of theirs now. But those kind of elements were something that they definitely brought into Seven Sun. And not only that, but I mean, this is kind of the point where it felt like Maiden started to go full prog. You know, it's conceptually very heavy. There's more long songs on there. I think the title track clocks in at 9 minutes and there's real sprawling kind of proggy story-esque masterpiece. Yeah, where should we start?
Well, man, I mean, I'm going to try to do this without giving away what my choice is here. You know, it's difficult. So, you know, can we begin with the artwork?
Yes, let's.
Okay. Because, you know, I have a very personal story, which you guys have probably heard, you know, 100 times. But yeah, I mean, I will never forget the moment that I discovered and fell in love with Iron Maiden. And it was the artwork. I had seen them before. My parents had brought home a Betamax, thereby securing my status as definitely the coolest kid on the block with the superior format that everybody adopted. No, they didn't, of course. There was a sample videotape on there with the video for Run to the Hills. But it kind of went over my head a little bit, you know. But my mother was having her hair done, and there was a record shop across the way, and they had a big Seventh Son poster in there. And I remember being utterly transfixed, just sitting there. It was like a spotlight was down on me, and I remember just kind of absorbing every detail, but being repulsed by the imagery. And going home that day and asked my dad, who gave me a very thoughtful answer to what an Iron Maiden is. But you know, it just lodged something in my brain that to this day has never gone away, which is just a fascination with Maiden. And it started there. I mean, that weird disembodied kind of cybernetic awfulness, you know, which I'm convinced that the Borg Queen from Star Trek First Contact, you know, I think they ripped it off from that album cover.
Oh man, I've never thought of that before.
I can't verify it. I'm just saying.
That's spot on.
But what an album cover. And I got to hand the mic over because we have to talk about the music. Again, as Donald Trump would say, bigly.
Let's try and not invoke Donald Trump too much. People will get the wrong idea. Yeah, I mean, for me, this was the album I think this was the first album that I went back to after I got into Maiden. It might have been. But yeah, just coming off of Brave New World. And then I probably would have picked up A Number of the Beast, to be fair. And then delving into this era, it's just like fascinating what they decided to do with this record. Yeah, let's go for it song by song. Opening with Moonchild, that kind of iconic strummed opening with Bruce singing delicately over the top. And then the tone of that guitar as it comes in is just.
I was thinking the same thing. Like how much I love that guitar tone on across the whole album.
Yeah, it's a real kind of lush, warm kind of feeling that they hadn't quite invoked in the same way before. And yeah, I mean, I think if we're making comparisons early on, I think Moonchild is a classic opener. It's hard to compare any song to Aces High. for instance. But the run of songs that come after that on the, you know, if we again treat this as it was meant to be consumed on the first half of the record, Infinite Dreams into Can I Play With Madness into The Evil That Men Do is pretty phenomenal. Agreed?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I mean, just if you're a Maiden fan up until this point, I mean, it's just, it's absolute manna from heaven. I mean, I could just imagine people freaking out and just doing little dances around in the rooms when this first came out, who had listened to it from the beginning and just thought, what are this band on right now? Because it was just, yeah, I mean, just end to end, I think it's not just that it conceptually hangs together, you know, just so beautifully. I mean, there's just so many parts of it that, you know, all feel kind of pompous and huge, but yeah, it's got pace and it's got tone, and, you know, their longtime producer, Martin Birch, I think just brought the best out of them. And, you know, I think, you know, I can't give my choice away yet, but I can tell you this, you know, I mean, I think this album for me is the ultimate expression of, you know, a band at their creative peak, you know, just absolutely setting the bar on what they can achieve and what most bands dream of achieving.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of the song structure, again, talking about that thing of an album being into side one, side two, you look at Power Slave that had that run of, like we talked about earlier, Lost for Words, Flash of the Blade, the Duelist, more kind of bouncy, gung-ho, fun songs, and then coming back with Back in the Village, which is a, you know, a bit more epic and a bit more, almost a bit kind of like a sinister vibe to it. This album finishes side one with The Evil That Men Do, which for me might have the most emotional hook that Maiden have ever written. It really, like that again, that guitar tone really gets under your skin and pulls at you. It feels so urgent and just vivid and, like I said, emotional. And then it comes back in on side two with Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, which is really where this album goes full prog, nearly 10 minutes long, just this winding kind of narrative, super proggy, Bruce Dickinson in his storytelling elements vibe. I mean, I think this was absolutely a Steve Harris song, if I'm not mistaken, and you can kind of see where he would take this kind of structure moving forwards. But yeah, I just think it's a really interesting dynamic to finish with The Evil That Men Do and then come back into Seventh Son. What do you guys think about that portion of the album? Because it's two very different sides of what this album has to offer, I feel.
Yeah, I think The Evil That Men Do, I think it does have that emotional quality in the same way that Blood Brothers does. Mm. You know, I think those are the two most emotional songs. But yeah, it feels like it's the end of one chapter and the beginning of the next, which is exactly what a vinyl record should do.
I mean, I think it's almost what we should probably talk about, Can I Play With Madness as well, because it's one of their biggest singles, and it's one of their strangest songs in a lot of ways, because the way the chorus comes in on that track is quite jarring almost. Do you know what I mean? It just kind of gate crashes into the song rather than kind of flows into it. And then it does that weird key change where it just goes off on one. And I'm saying this picking what, in my opinion, is a run of 10 out of 10 songs, one after the other, really. But I would actually say on that first half of the record, Can I Play With Madness is probably, how can I put this, the slightly least brilliant of the songs.
I disagree.
You disagree?
Yeah. I think, I know what you mean about like it being, you know, a little bit jarring, but I think the whole song feels really live. And like I said before on Ancient Rhyme of the Mariner, is when they all suddenly get a cue and they all follow each other and they all just like suddenly like ramp up together, and you can feel this energy like going throughout the band. And it's like in any other hands, you know, there's a danger that a song like that and some of those rhythms could be a bit workmanlike. But when you see the whole band like becoming, you know, all getting this cue and like following each other into when it sort of increases the pace, it becomes, you know, the machine just moves so smoothly, it becomes more than the sum of its parts. Mm. And there's a nice symmetry on that record as well, too, like with the, you know, it just, so I just think that record all really holds together. And I think the change of the tempo, like the when it shifts up, it really pulls you with it. And because you can feel the whole band pulling with the change of tempo. And so I absolutely love that song.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to be clear, I think it's one of the greatest heavy metal songs ever written. I just happen to think it's in a bed of some of the greatest heavy metal songs ever written. But yeah, second half of the album has a slightly different pace and feel to the first, I feel. Obviously starts with Seven Sun, which I remember watching the first time I ever saw them play this, I'm pretty sure, was at Sonisphere, when Bruce started doing the kind of slick down like Misfits mohawk and getting a trench coat out and just absolutely living in the moment of the story of this track. And then it goes into The Prophecy, which is a slightly different vibe to some of the other songs. It's a little bit more like, not, I don't want to say plodding because that sounds negative, but it's maybe one of the more overlooked songs on this album. The Clairvoyant's an absolute classic, obviously. And I think Only the Good Die Young. Again, there's just something about the guitar tone they've got on this record that's really emotional and just feels really urgent and vital. And the way the kind of that frantic ending to the record that this track brings, I think is really powerful and very, very different to what they were doing, for instance, with Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah, I think there's something else I really love about this record. That is that it's really of its time. Like, you can hear like the 80s gloss sort of getting under the skin of it. Like, some, you know, Seventh Son has a kind of like slightly glossy keys feel to it. There's even a moment early on we could almost imagine a disco beat underneath Seventh Son.
Yeah.
It just, and
it's, you know, it, and it's it, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I love the fact that it's, you know, it's kind of, it's got this element of its time, like that kind of, that sort of, this kind of 80s gloss that just seems to be swimming under the surface of the whole album. And it makes it a lot more live and sensual, I think. And sometimes things that have, you know, they're of their time, that's what makes them really timeless.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the time, Jonathan. I mean, I pulled up a list because I was kind of curious. I mean, because it's always important, I think, to kind of situate things, you know, in their own times and to sort of understand the context, right? And when you consider what else was happening in 1988, you know, Rick Astley, you know, had a number one with Never Gonna Give You Up, you know, Richard Marx was huge. Obviously, there was a lot of rock in the charts, but there was a lot of, you know, enormous sort of, you know, ultra produced kind of pop music, you know? And so, you know, it kind of makes you appreciate what Maiden were doing, not just because of what it was in its own right, but because of what it sort of stood against, you know, just like where the grain was in terms of popular music. And let's not forget, rock, metal were in a very different place in the 1980s, you know? This music was not something that people felt, you know, protective of. It was as big as it could possibly get, right? And Maiden were achieving enormous commercial success, you know, huge creative expression, doing something that completely flew in the face of anything else that was kind of happening. I mean, it's no disrespect to Billy Ocean, but man, I mean, this is a record that was sort of, you know, proudly defiant of any of that. And I think that's one of the things that makes it kind of cool to consider now, is what they were doing was so self-consciously different, and not because they wanted to be, but because that's who they were.
That's a really important point. Absolutely. Like, Maiden have, I think one of the things that defines them and is why they have always managed to stay so important to metal fans is that they've just never compromised on a single thing. And this, I believe, went to number one in the album charts in the UK, which is insane, really. I mean, now we're obviously, because Maiden is such a big deal now and they've kind of become an absolute franchise, that you kind of would expect them to be getting a number one album just because they're so huge. They're second only to Metallica as easily the second biggest metal band of all time. And whoever's next in that line is far, far behind them. But at this point in time, for a band to be doing that kind of weird shit and landing one number one albums is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, like Alex said before, they were in their own creative bubble. So I don't know if it was kind of defiant. It's just like impervious to everything else that was going on. Because 88, there was a lot going on, like musically, not, you know, not just in the charts, but on the sort of alternative side of things. Like for indie music, 88 was one of the greatest years ever, like the Young Gods and Skinny Puppy. And there was so much innovation going on the sort of on the underground scene as well, too. But Iron Maiden were just like you said, in this own bubble and impervious to everything. They're like this self-feeding machine in a way that, you know, develops and evolves on its own terms.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else any of you guys want to say about either Power Slave or Seven Son of Seven Son before we get to the votes none of us want to have to make?
Oh.
Just in Seventh Son, there's some chants in it that really remind me of Emperor, like circa Nightside Eclipse.
Interesting.
That's a really interesting point. You know, well, you know, I think it's going to have to be asked of Ishan whether that's where it comes from. You know, I certainly wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah.
But I think the moment has come.
The moment has indeed come. We are not comparing two fantastic Maiden albums. We are literally comparing two of the single greatest metal records ever made. I mean, if you were compiling a list where you could, you know, put as many choices by individual bands as you wanted, these would both have a shout at being very, 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 very high in the all-time great list for metal. This is not an easy decision. I'm going to start with Alex, I think.
Oh, I thought you were going to choose. I thought you were going to say your choice.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, I'm not saying I'm going to go last necessarily. I'm just interested to see how this... I just want to drag this out for the drama as much as I can. Alex, yeah. If you had to choose... Remember, this is not... doesn't have to be your favorite album necessarily. It couldn't be. But this is the album that will be forever cemented in the podcast Hall of Fame. Power Slave or Seven Son of a Seven Son?
You're basically sitting there. There's someone with a gun to your head. You have the two records in front of you, and they say, "Now smash one."
Yeah.
Right. This is the brutality. It is not choosing one. It is not choosing the other.
Exactly. That's very well put.
So hard.
And I genuinely think this could have been the hardest two albums to choose from in their catalog, just because of the pure song power. What they both meant for them at the time.
Okay.
Tough one.
Seventh Son of a Seventh Son has to win it for me. Has to win it for me. Has to. Wow. There. I said it.
It's been said. It cannot be taken back.
No, it's done. It's written on my forehead for all time.
Jonathan, what is your decision?
As much as Power Slave has some of the most classic Maiden songs they'll ever be, as a whole, as an album, I'm going to have to also go for Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. And also just because I love that crisp Radiant guitar tone. It goes so well with the cover as well. I'm Seventh Son too.
Wow, gentlemen, that is actually a clean sweep for Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. Alex was the one I was least sure of. I did wonder if you might go Power Slave on us, which is why I went with us first. But yeah, I think, I mean, you know, a band's special when you've got Power Slave in a vote off and it doesn't get a single vote because it's just that good.
Yeah, but you know, I'm so pleased that, you know, I don't have to delete either of your numbers from my phone. We can hang out again when that's again possible.
Jonathan's is under review because of his comments.
Space. Go back and listen to it and tell me if there's not something in there.
But do we all agree on that? That's the question.
But yeah,
I think Seventh Son is pretty much flawless, a flawless record.
I'd have to agree. It's just it's such. I think it manages the very unique feat that maybe we sometimes take for granted of. You can pick any one song out of it and it would belong on a Maiden greatest hits or, you know, a Maiden best songs mix. But as a complete journey through an album, it absolutely works as a whole as well.
I completely agree. You know, just, you know, from the artwork to the final note, you know, to me, you know, this could, you know, be seen as a little unfair, but, you know, I think of Iron Maiden's history in chapters. You know, and I guess in many ways, for me, this is the peak moment for Iron Maiden chapter one. You know, creatively, it is the ultimate expression of what they are. If someone asked me, you know, what is Iron Maiden? I'm not sure if it's the first record that I would give to them because it is a lot to take on. But as an Iron Maiden fan, you know, I have to say that, you know, this has to stand in in chapter one, I think is their proudest moment. We mentioned Brave New World, because I mean, just like what an incredible comeback record, you know, and it is not to be that sneering gray beard going, you know what, this was something that I experienced and younger generations can't have their own records. Everyone's entitled to their favorites. But when you line everything up end to end, you know, I have to say this is just top of the proverbial pyramid. And, you know, it is an album that I can say I still go back to today, and I'm still wowed by what they've done.
Incredible. Yeah, I know what I'm going to be listening to as soon as we finish recording this podcast for the second time today. All right. Whew. I feel good that that's off our chest, guys. We did it. Thank fuck. Now we can all just go back to enjoy them all equally. So Seven Son of a Seven Son joins Antichrist Superstar in the Metal Hammer Podcast Hall of Fame. Stay tuned to facebook.com/Metal Hammer Readers where we will reveal the next band that we will be debating, which will come along, I think, sooner rather than later. Let's run through some reader questions. If you want to come ask us some questions for the podcast or just hang out with us generally, it's the same address I just mentioned, facebook.com/Metal Hammer Readers. We're doing some great stuff. We did our first Mario Kart tournament the other week. That was really good fun. We'll do another one of those soon. Loads of great debates and conversations and recommendations and playlists getting played in there. Really appreciate the community we've got building there. And we're all going to get through this thing together down there. I think I know the answer to this question as far as you two are concerned, you know. Mark Baker asks, do any of you play an instrument? How about a Metal Hammer band to keep us going through the dark times?
Jonathan?
I used to play classical guitar when I was a kid.
Oh, I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah, I took lessons. I got to book two of Tune a Day. I could see music and play it straight away. But, you know, kids, there's usually one thing that every kid is good at. Like naturally good at, or they're naturally fascinated with, and I was kind of more books, you know. I just my actual genuine talents and the things I understood on a really instinctive level was like how a sentence worked rather than how like a chord sequence worked, and so I was never a natural. I always wonder how good I'd be if I'd carried on, but sometimes you just gotta be honest with yourself and know that like that kind of, you don't really have that in your bones. It's just none of my family has any kind of any musical talent. My immediate family has any musical talent whatsoever. And I tried and I got as far as I could at that time with it. But it wasn't the thing. If I was good at any one thing, that was playing music, wasn't it for me? As much as I loved listening to it and, you know, tried to do the best I could.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just be straight up. I can't play an instrument because I wasn't very good at it. And like most music journalists, that's probably why I'm doing this instead.
Yeah, people say journalists are like, you know, they wish they were musicians, but like that was when I was 10, you know, 8 or 10.
Yeah, no, I mean, I never had any.
I've got a long time. To get over that. Yeah.
Alex.
It's all about the bass clef. I was a trombonist for a while, you know, very classically trained, and and then I got way into bass guitar, you know, playing in metal bands and all that kind of stuff, kind of growing up, you know, and you know, there is a bit of a cliche about, you know, a lot of, you know, music journalists are, wannabe musicians or whatever else. And I think that's true. I think people just respond to music in different ways. Some want to emulate it, some want to intellectualize it. You know, most people do a bit of all of it, you know, and I never stopped considering myself a musician. But, certainly through music journalism, I've, you know, discovered a whole new respect for what it takes to persevere in an incredibly difficult industry. I think we just register it all in different ways. But, you know, it definitely gave me, I think, a better understanding of, you know, a lot of what was happening, and possibly, you know, meant that, you know, I go to Dream Theater shows and experience it in a different way than other people do, because you're just sort of looking at what people are doing from a technical standpoint more than taking in the music. But given the current circumstances, you never know, maybe trombone is what metal needs.
Well, it's funny you say that, because Eleanor plays sax, so we could get she used to play saxophone, so we could kind of get a Metal Hammer brass section going.
Well, I don't think Ishan would disagree. I mean,
we've got
nothing wrong with it, but, you know, Ghost.
I have a trombonist now.
There you go.
And an Imperial Triumphant have a trombonist occasionally too. Avant-garde black metal.
Where it's at, man. It's where it's at.
It's very Krieg.
Indeed.
Marco LG says, this is probably a useful one for everyone wanting to have some good stuff to watch over the coming weeks. Favorite band documentary, And he says, despite Iron Maiden's early years being a great gem, my favorite is Beyond the Lighted Stage by Rush, which I've never seen actually. What are your favorite music documentaries, chaps?
Oh, is it just one?
No, reel off some.
Oh, man. You know, I think one of the most excruciating and fascinating ones is Beware of Mr. Baker, you know, about Ginger Baker, of course, from Cream.
Right.
Okay. You know, and I mean, that is just a big car crash. But man, you get such a sense of this guy who was just an absolute genius and a real piece of work, too. You know, I think, you know, in honor of, you know, the subject matter today, you know, Flight 666 is just such a great summation of what they achieved globally. Beyond the Light Stage is absolutely brilliant. You know, absolutely one of the greatest bands that I've ever played. Just trying to think of some others that have really blown my mind. You know, of course, aside from the one that I produced.
we should toot our own horn. Like, we both made documentaries.
Indeed. Yeah.
That was the fantastic Monomath documentary, which is it out on, I guess it's out on DVD by now, isn't it?
Because DVD, Blu-ray, I think you can
sorry, yeah. DVD, no. Such a brand name.
Really sorry there. Really sorry there, guys.
Out on mini disc.
Okay, I will leave.
No, it's a good documentary, man. And, you know, it's good to see. That's exactly, I think one of the great things about metal is that's exactly the kind of band that you maybe wouldn't have envisioned getting that kind of career retrospective treatment 20 years ago. So it's just fantastic to see that.
No, I mean, most people were surprised that they've been around for 25 years. But I guess what makes a great documentary, though, is just trying to get under the skin, you know. And I think through the process of doing that documentary and working on others that are upcoming, there is, you know, it's very apparent to me, just like one of the greatest challenges that people have is, you know, dealing with people that have become so adept at expressing themselves musically and getting them to talk about their feelings, you know, and that's a different thing altogether. And certainly, I think one of the things that makes documentaries great for me is it, just like great music journalism, it gives depth to the artists and it makes you feel like you come away knowing them in some level.
Absolutely. I mean, on that note, in terms of getting under the skin, obviously I've got Some Kind of Monster on here. It feels like that documentary is something you kind of assume everyone's seen it, but I mean, it's that documentary 16 years ago now. So if you happen to have come into metal since then, there's a chance you might have missed it. But in terms of compelling and occasionally car crash viewing, I still think Some Kind of Monster is one of the bravest things Metallica have done in terms of putting themselves out there. It's a fascinating insight into where the bands were at that point in time. And I think given how much real love it feels like there is around the scene for Metallica in the last few years, it's mad to think that they were just in this crazy position when they were just totally breaking down and not, you know, not getting on with each other and really struggling in the studio and all the rest of it. It's still a fascinating watch. I still really like Metal, A Headbanger's Journey. In a way, it's almost like a primer for people that aren't into metal in the first place. Like, if you're already into it, it's not going to teach you a whole lot that you don't already know about. But it's just really cool to see all these great personalities popping up across the thing that Sam Dunn put together. The Anvil documentary is obviously a classic, amazing, heartwarming story there. The Lemmy documentary from, frighteningly, about 10 years ago now was really good fun. And I just tacked on a couple of more recent and actually not metal documentaries, but the Amy Winehouse one's fantastic. That's just called Amy. Very sad, but also interesting look into her amazing, but unfortunately short life. The Oasis documentary Supersonic is just fucking great as well. And I really like the Lady Gaga documentary 5'2" that's on Netflix. That's just a really interesting one as well.
I want to also give out a shout out to some of the a couple of all-time classics. Heavy Metal Parking Lot, obviously. You know, just right. Just so American. Decline of Western Civilization Part 2 is amazing. And I also really liked Heavy Metal in Baghdad, about the band Akrasi Kelda that was stuck in there. I interviewed them once, actually. They made it out of Baghdad and into Turkey, and they're still having a shit old time. And yeah, well, we are one of my favorite things. I'm just going to get toot my own horn as well. One of my favorite things they ever did was for our old company, doing the documentary with Phil Wallace on London by North, which was the story of Vardruna enslaved and how they came together to create Skookshaw. And you know, all props to Phil, because the way he went up in the mountains in January, freezing his tits off, shot all these amazing cutaways in the hills of Bergen, and the way he edited it was incredible.
You can actually still watch this, by the way, on the Metal Hammer YouTube page. So if you go into YouTube and search London by North documentary, you can still watch this.
Yeah, and you know, both Einar and Ivar from Slave are such interesting, articulate, and quite, you know, people don't, you know, sort of quite, you know, very entertaining individuals as well too. But we also spoke to Garland and Ivar, you know, ex and old Fordruna. And it really told a story, and I'm super proud of it. And it's largely because of all the amazing work that Phil did. But I still think, you know, I had a connection to those bands that you don't even hear my voice on it. But I was really proud of that.
Cool, and a fine choice as well. Let's rattle through a few more questions. David Connell says, Maiden related, in honor of today's Hall of Fame. Were Blaze Bailey's generally maligned years in Iron Maiden really that bad? I saw them on the Virtual 11 tour, and it meant I got to see Iron Maiden in a 3,000 cap venue, giant inflatable, Eddie and all. Those years were obviously a commercial nadir, but it wasn't all bad, right? I feel like the cliche that the Blaze Bailey years of Iron Maiden were crap, it's kind of not really widely accepted now. I feel like most people recognize that they did some fantastic stuff in that time now. What do you guys think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll be honest. You know, anybody who's been out on the Legacy of the Beast tour at any date knows that one of the absolute high points of that set is The Clansman, you know, which, of course,
absolutely,
you know, it's just got to be one of the greatest Iron Maiden songs that I've ever written. And, you know, I mean, just like, you know, personally, having had the pleasure of spending some time around Blaze, interviewing him, I mean, he is just like the nicest, humblest, loveliest guy in the world, you know. You know, so, I mean, I feel defensive of him on that level, but also defensive of that era as well. I mean, the 90s were a difficult time for any band that kind of came before, because it's like everything just sort of got, you know, and that it's like that Raiders of the Lost Ark line, yet it's like wiped clean by the wrath of God. I mean, it was just everything changed, because I think history began to fold back on itself, and suddenly rock, metal, all these things were self-aware, and a new wave of things kind of came in. And unfortunately for Maiden, it was like the perfect storm. The times had changed, and so would their singer. And so I think it's an era that deserves a reassessment. You know, I don't think that it is right that it is maligned to the extent that it is, but there is absolutely no question that with the return of Bruce Dickinson, Iron Maiden began a new chapter in their career, and one that sort of continues to this day.
I think that's completely fair. Let's do a couple more. Scott Sitompul says, what would be the title of your autobiography?
I have a story behind this. Mine would be ...
Okay.
Reason being, so when in the 90s, when I used to write for Melody Maker, one of our session editors, he had a diary, like an address book, and me and my colleague and good friend Taylor Parks, we broke into his computer and looked at his entries for everything, and he had a little description of every writer. So Taylor's was talented hack and preposterous individual. Simon Reynolds, the guy who made me want to be a music writer in the first place, his was a master, and mine just said and I never know quite sure which way he meant, which, you know, which side of the that was, but that was the point. And I think, yeah, some things just shouldn't have answers in life, and that's definitely one of them. Yeah, so, it just seemed perfectly right.
Alex, what would yours be?
Oh gosh, I mean, it's an impossible question. I mean, maybe is this thing on? I have no idea, but I mean, I mean, ask me again in 30 years, okay? I think I might have a better answer, but maybe it'll come to me.
All right. Mine will probably be, yes, it is my real name. just to save everyone some time. let's do one more. Bradley Cassidy says, now we have more time to ourselves and we're likely to be bored. Do you have any tips on getting into music journalism? Bradley says he's done his undergraduate degree and he's about to apply for a master's in PR. To go alongside this, he's up in the Northwest. Shout out everyone in the Northwest. How do you reckon someone outside London achieves this goal? Alex, you're from a little outside of London.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Naples, in Italy. I was born in London, grew up in Naples, in Virginia, in the States. And I mean, the truth is, I don't think that there's ever been, a similar trajectory for any two music journalists, because so many people come from different areas. But I think I would say to anyone, especially now, I mean, because, music journalism comprises so many different things. I mean, broadcast, podcasting, video making, all these sorts of things. And fundamentally writing as well, I think to be a great writer, you've got to be a good reader. I think to be a good music journalist, you should be a great consumer of music journalism that is out there that you respect and admire. And I think you have to try and master the medium before you begin, kind of getting into that world. So if you want to be, if you want to be a great writer, you've got to write, and you've got to love that thing first. And I think that's, the thing that's very apparent, I think, of people that do have careers is, they have adapted to this changing landscape. But I mean, at the core of any great music journalist is a great fan of the music, I think, but also, a great storyteller, and someone capable of doing the thing that we've just done, loving something enough to be able to talk about it for 90 minutes and still have some gas in the tank.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's all fine advice. And just to say, in terms of, being from the North and outside the London bubble, Eleanor, who's our deputy editor and on this podcast most weeks, she's from Manchester, so she's Northeast. I'm sure she would have some good advice on that kind of stuff as well, if anyone wants to hit her up on the Facebook reader page.
I've got one point specifically for music magazines and one point more universally. Specifically to music magazines, read the magazine.
That does help, because when we get pitch stuff, obviously we're always delighted to have people want to write for us, and it's a privilege to be in a position where people want to do that. But we can tell quite quickly if someone's not read the magazine.
If you're a photographer, you can look at different magazines and you see how they frame stuff, because you understand how something is constructed. So if you have the insight to see how they, like it was a photographer, they frame stuff. If you're like a writer, you would notice genuinely you cared about the craft of the writing. You would notice whether they use first person, whether they use what tense they do certain things in. And don't just set, it's very easy just to send something you knocked off for on a blog and send it to Mel Hammer, but you don't write like that. So, you have to like be aware of the world in which any magazine, particular magazine you want to work for, lives in, because you want to be part of our world. Well, I want you to know that you understand our world and you want to be part of it. On a broader, more existential level, just like ask yourself one very searching question, which is, why am I doing this? If you think it's glamorous, then
ask myself that every day. No, I'm joking.
yeah, but you have to have an answer to that question. Do you have some insight? A lot of people, they send stuff in, it reads like a diary entry, and it's like, well, I don't understand why you want to write for Mel Hammer, or something like that. So, do you have a love of words? Are you engaging? Do you love kind of engaging with people? And especially in a world now where you can go straight on online and hear a piece of music, you have to do something in journalism that you can't just get this into a piece of music, which is a bit of context. Being able to, help people, be able to sort of make people sort of listen to something in a new way, pick up something they might not have noticed, that kind of like deep listening, whatever. But ask yourself, why am I doing this? And that's a really personal question. And I think in any form of craft or art or anything that you're doing, you have to really good answer to that question.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I like doing this is because we get to have conversations about the things we love, like we have today, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you both, fellas. That is, I think, just about it for this week's show. If you have any thoughts on it, come to the Facebook reader group. I've told you the address enough times, I'm sure now. Jonathan, we'll have you back on very soon, I'm sure. And Alex, it's been an absolute pleasure. Please do come back anytime.
An absolute honor. What a delight to hang out with you guys. And
cheers with you, Alex.
Yeah, indeed. We'll have to do this more.
We will. I'll try to give you something less agonized to preside over next time as well.
Yeah, I'm glad we can all be friends.
Until the next one. All right. Thanks, everybody. Cheers for listening. And we'll see you next week. And yeah, keep your eyes on metalhammer.com. As always, there's loads of great stuff happening. So we'll see you all soon. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.